Welcome to Take Two Radio. I'm Pam, your host, and joining me today is my special guest co-host and friend, Mike Lidskin of Twirl Radio. Hi, Mike.
Hey, Pam. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. Thanks for asking. How about yourself?
Pretty good. It's finally cooled down. You know, yesterday it was 110 degrees, and then by the time it got dark, like 3 hours later, it went down to 70. It went from 110 to 70, like a 40-degree drop, and say it's just going to be perfect, like sunny, 80 degrees. I went out for a bike ride, so I'm enjoying spring now that I'm not roasting.
Yeah, I would imagine, 110. I mean,
that's something.
Not normal for California, is it?
It would be normal for us maybe once in a while in July or August, not first week of June. It's just a little extraordinary here. Wow.
And we've been battling with the opposite of it being cold here. And
man,
recently, in the last couple of days, it's been, you know, perfect weather in this. It's, say, upper 60s and lower 70s. So I've been happy with that. Mm-hmm.
I would
yeah.
take that. Hey, congratulations to you guys on your Chicago Blackhawks. Way to go for you guys.
Oh, my God. Thank God people do not videotape me when I'm watching a Hawks game. Let me tell you, I know that my neighbors must hate me, and my dog definitely hates when I'm watching the Blackhawks. She will not come near me. She hears the music starting in the beginning and runs out of the room. She can't handle me yelling, and I'm yelling either because I'm happy or I'm yelling because I'm mad.
That's too funny.
And last night was pretty intense. I mean, they went into two overtimes before they finally won.
Wow. So you put your dog through the ringer on that one.
Oh, my gosh, you have no idea. I was sitting, I was standing, I was in front of my TV. I went back to sitting, I was up standing, I was back yelling. And the thing is, you know, the game's not over till it's over. Till you see that counter go down to zero, it's not over.
Right.
At 7.9 seconds left of the game, the Hawks were winning. And at that moment, the Kings scored. And that's how we ended up in two OTs.
Wow. That's pretty intense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's very dramatic and probably makes for some great television.
Oh, I'm sure it does. It was funny because I was tweeting all this stuff with fellow Blackhawks fans, and those that were not actually started watching the game because of what we were tweeting.
Wow. The internet is an ambassador for hockey.
Yeah. So it should be pretty interesting now they play the Bruins, and I guess they're pretty hard, you know, to a team to beat. So it should be interesting. So it'll be a lot of yelling from my end as well.
You're a poor dog. That's all I'm going to say.
Yeah, I know. I know, but what are you going to do? It's only, you know, one time a year I do this, so she can live with it.
Yeah, but exactly.
Today we should have an extremely interesting show considering who our guest is. We welcome the award-winning musician, video producer, performer, and digital storyteller, Andrew Potter, whose one-man show is called The Road to High Street. So welcome, Andrew, and I hope you're a hockey fan, and it's a Blackhawks one at that.
Well, you got me half right. Thank you. Thank you very much for having me. And sorry, I haven't been following lately. Who are we contending with now in the hockey finals?
The Blackhawks and the Bruins.
I'm sorry, but I am a New Englander by birth, so I'm going to have to be voting for the Bruins. Sorry about that.
No rivalry going on here.
As long as you don't do it in front of me, then you're okay with me.
All right. Okay. All right. Well, the good thing then is the game's not going on during the interview, and that would be
you're right. Well, it wouldn't happen in the first place. So, and Mike is a Chicago native, so you have to be, going for the Blackhawks.
Actually, I'm a
otherwise,
California
I will
base,
not
so.
Forgive you.
Okay, I'm going for the Blackhawks, even though I was born in California. Yes.
Okay. Well, let's find out more about Andrew. Can we get started with some background for our listeners who may not be familiar with who you are? How did you get started in music, or is music the thing that came first?
Well, music is the thing that came first, and music led me in so many different directions, which have kind of culminated in this current project. But I'm a guitar player, mostly acoustic guitar player, self-taught, and I've been playing for 40-some years. And I realized very early on, when I was about 14, 15, when I started playing, that it was something that I really loved. I was really motivated to work at, and I was pretty good. Early on, I was pretty good. And so I worked very, very hard at it. And develop some proficiency. And kind of the way it led off is I auditioned when I was a freshman in college many, many years ago. I auditioned and got into a little children's theater company in Providence, Rhode Island, where I grew up. Mm-hmm. And I played them an old jazz tune on the guitar. It was a song called Never Swat a Fly. It's like a 20s jazz tune.
Oh, fun.
And it's really funny, fun and clever lyrics. And the director loved it. And he saw a couple things in the tune. I didn't know this at the time, but he saw a couple things at the tune which made him love it so much. One of it was, I think, just my style of performing it. You know, it's an old jazz tune, so it's kind of upbeat, and it's very happy, and it's very syncopated. And the other was is that he saw that it could be very easily mimed. The song was called Never Swat a Fly, and it was basically about a love affair between all these different insects. And he saw how it could be very mimed by the actors. And mm-hmm. So that's what we turned it into. So this is a children's theater company. There were five of us. And I was the music director, and it was a little company called Circus Wagon Theater. And we had two other guys who were on board with us who were gymnasts, and we had two other women who were mimes and dancers. And between the five of us, we would write these skits, and we'd act them out and play them out and throw in some gymnastics and some juggling. And that tune and that gig is kind of how I got started performing.
Wow, very interesting. I mean, if you hadn't been at that children's theater, it may not have taken off that way.
Well, that's true. It was just kind of happened to work out. When I was a freshman in college, I heard about this theater company, and at the same time, I had met my performing partner, Wheeler Cole, who I ended up performing with for about 20 years. I met him as a freshman at URI, and I met him because it was so funny the way this worked out. I was moving into my dorm, and I met this guy who was riding or trying to ride a unicycle in the hallway.
No.
And he had another friend with him, and they were just kind of crashing around and laughing their heads off and struggling and riding, and I kind of passed by them as I moved in and observed these guys doing this stuff. And I said, oh, that's kind of funny. And then a little bit later, Wheeler, as my partner's name is, he also plays the banjo. And I was playing a little bit of banjo at the time, and he heard me playing the banjo, and he came over and he said, hey, you play the banjo. And so that's kind of how we hit it off. And just
put
this music thing going again.
Yeah.
And,
interesting.
And
banjos
sort of how we started.
Banjos and unicycles, that's a lot of fun, banjos and unicycles. It's interesting. I have a friend up here who has a unicycle, and he's a performer too. His is a mountain unit. He's actually got a knobby wheel on the one wheel on the unicycle.
I understand that. I used to have one of those myself. In fact, when we were learning to ride the unicycles, we used to play this game. This is going way back. We used to play this game where we'd ride around our college campus, and we had this game that we called Blood and Guts. And basically, we would just pick up a stick, and we'd be riding unicycles, and you just kind of go over and start to harass and poke the other person with the stick.
Oh my gosh!
Eventually, it's so distracting that you fall off really quickly. But after a while, we got really good at staying on. So it became more and more combative, and it just became excellent training for learning how to ride the unicycle. If you can ride, and you got some guy whacking you with a stick at the same time.
You're going to get good after a while. Maybe you should consider unicycle polo or something like that.
Yeah.
Well, that's been tried. Yeah, we have tried games like that.
That's awesome.
That is just too funny, because all I can picture is, you know, the guys on the horses that are, you know, the knights and whatever, when they go stick each other or try to stick each other, and here you are on a unicycle doing the same thing. That's too funny.
And we got so good at it that, you know, you can start to kind of lean into delivering your blows, and you can also anticipate when you're going to get hit, so you can kind of lean into getting hit. So it got very violent after a while, which hence the name Blood and Guts.
Yes.
Well, hopefully towards the end when you were really good at it, there wasn't as much blood.
Well, actually, no, that's not true, because the next obvious step after that was to do it on 6-foot unicycles.
Oh my gosh. Of course that would be the next obvious step.
Of course, right. And the thing about 6-foot unicycles is once you learn how to get up there and stay up there, they're actually easier to ride than short unicycles, right?
I would never imagine.
Well, your center of gravity is so much higher that, you know, you have much more control. You know, it's like, what's easier to balance on your finger, a pool stick or a pencil?
Good point.
So you got the pool stick, you got your center of gravity that's way up high. That's really easy. Well, it's the same thing with the 6-foot unicycle. So, again, you know, we're playing Blood and Guts now on the 6-foot unicycle. And, again, we're leaning into our body blows and surviving. But then when you do go down, it's a long way down. And you hope you land on your feet.
Right.
So I'm sure this is all great background for your career as it is today.
Exactly. Now, you've also talked about juggling, and I read that you practiced in a cemetery before you became part of the duo with Leo. Wheeler as the High Street Circus.
Well, you'll see. There's a good reason for this, which I will reveal to you shortly. But the cemetery, again, was near our college. And when we were in college, we used to hitchhike. In fact, that's where the name High Street came from, because the High Street bordered the cemetery.
Okay.
And we used to hitchhike down High Street, and we'd stop off at McGrath's Packy. You know what a packy is?
No.
It's a New England term. It's short for package store, a.k.a. a liquor store.
Okay.
You know, just you bring it out in a package. But so we used to stop off at the Packy, and, you know, just to clear the air here, at the time, the drinking age was 18, so we were not underage drinkers.
Right.
We'd go down and couple little something, and then we'd head off to the cemetery, which was a nice outdoor private spot to kind of hang out. That's really all it was.
Mm-hmm.
And we just started hanging out there. And, you know, we'd imbibe a little, and we'd discuss and argue and, you know, talk about life. And along the way, we just started practicing our juggling. And so we spent a lot of time kind of developing our act and also sort of dreaming about what we might do with it someday in this cemetery in Peacedale, Rhode Island.
Well, you definitely wouldn't hurt anybody if you dropped whatever you were juggling. That was a good thing.
That's a good point. And I can only assume that we kept everybody entertained.
Right?
Yes.
Now, what's the craziest thing you ever juggled?
Well, I guess probably the most difficult technical thing in our show. Well, actually, I will tell you, before I get to that, I will tell you one of the craziest things we ever juggled back in the experimental days when we were still in college. You know, you've heard about people juggling fire, right?
Yes.
Right.
They use fire sticks, which is fire at one end and handle at the other.
Yeah.
And we thought, oh, that's for wimps, you know. We're going to use fire balls and juggle them with our hands.
Oh.
So, yeah, we had this idea of, this is just, like I say, the experimental stage, of we took some tennis balls, and because they've got a little bit of, you know, fuzzy fabric on them, and then we doused them with a little, and, well, by the way, I wouldn't suggest anyone ever try this, because as I'm about to say, it failed.
Disclaimer.
It was not a good idea. But we sprinkled it with a little lighter fluid, and then we put on some, like, gardening gloves, and then you light them up, and we tried to juggle them.
Oh.
That doesn't sound safe at all or fun.
It was one of those ideas that sounds better than it actually is. And when, you know, you get one or two juggles in there, and then when we dropped it and it rolled under the bed, that's when we decided it was a bad idea.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Sounds pretty flammable.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, but, you know, trial and error.
Yes.
Right.
Lots of error.
Well, practice makes perfect, but there's just some things you shouldn't practice, and that's one of them.
Right. Well, now I know that.
Yeah.
Yes.
Now,
and
I'm so curious.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
You were asking about the other juggling things that we did, and for our finale, our show, we used to, we'd climb up on top of 2 6-foot unicycles, and this is on like a real small stage. You know, it's maybe a 10-foot square stage, you know, 3 feet off the ground. And the audience, there's like 300 or 400 people, and they're packed in really close. And we're up, so we're up on 6-foot unicycles. The stage is 3 feet off the ground, so our heads are like 10 feet up in the air.
Wow.
And we'd hand out 6 different objects to members of the audience. And let me see if I can remember what they were. We'd hand out It was a handball racket. It was like a tennis racket, a little bit smaller, but a racket. And we'd hand out this wooden brush. And they were all about the same shape, about the same length. We handed out a rubber chicken, one juggling club, a fire torch, and what am I missing? Oh, a toilet plunger. Of course, a toilet plunger.
Of course. That's comedy gold right there. Toilet plungers and rubber chickens are comedy gold.
Right. Yeah. You know, they practically speak for themselves.
Yes.
And then we'd hand them out to different people all over the audience, and then we'd climb up onto the unicycles, and then we'd have them one at a time, or actually two at a time, since there's two of us, throw the objects to us from wherever they were in the audience.
Wow.
Yeah. Now, this is one of those premises that plays out any number of ways.
I could see that, yeah.
And if it worked right, and it usually did, although over the course of performing it, that was one thing about our show, is our show is built up on all these premises that we just put out there, and then whatever happened, happened. And over the course of the years, all kinds of things happened, and that's what one of the things that made it kind of cool, because it really was very spontaneous. But if it works right, you know, we get to catch the items that they toss to us, and then the last one that they throw is from someone farthest away, and when it worked right, they toss, you know, we give them fairly explicit instructions, and they toss it to us, and as we catch it, the third one each, we're able to go into a juggling pattern from there. So that's one small miracle. Being able to catch the last one on the unicycle.
I mean, yeah, I mean, just catching this stuff in the first place, being 10 feet in the air, and then go ahead and juggle from there, my gosh, that's amazing.
Yeah. And then we turn and face each other, and then we do the club passing, where we pass to each other for the last finale of the show, those six different objects. So it was very challenging. But
a lot of variables at play there.
Yeah,
and the audience would
certainly
be a variable.
Absolutely, because, you know, some people could throw better than others.
Right. You don't want to end up with a rubber chicken in the spokes of the wheel either, you know.
Right. Well, it's funny you should mention that, because I have this scene in my show, which is a video clip of a performance that we did, where a kid tried to do exactly that.
Oh.
A kid
came up
on stage, and I asked him to pick up the rubber chicken, and he picked it up, and he started ramming it into my spoke.
Oh, my gosh.
It wasn't funny at
the
time. So I had to take off, and, of course, he came running after me. And he's, like, 2 or 3 years old, so...
He was determined.
Yeah, and also, you know, his adrenaline just kicks in because all of a sudden he's the center of attention and
right?
He's getting all this huge response from the audience. So he's motivated. So he's really coming after me. Finally, Wheeler had to come over, and the two of them hovering over him on our 6-foot unicycles and, you know, threatened to beat him back. But when I found the clip, I found the clip years later, you know, when I started assembling this show, and it was just so hilarious. I had to use it somehow, and I found a really nice spot for it in my show, so it's pretty funny.
That's
fantastic.
How old is the kid now? I mean, that's something you should reach out to him and say, hey, look at this, you know?
Well, yeah, possibly. Possibly. He might say, look, I'm in your show. Give me money.
Yeah.
That's true.
Right?
Yeah,
you
don't want
it
to backfire.
I kind of keep it on the down low. I mean, you know, if he finds out.
That's funny. Well, I'm also curious to know that you used to do busking, and that's something I normally hear from UK singers and bands. How did you get into that?
Well, busking is a term that's used probably a little bit more in Europe than it is here. Here it's more called just street performing.
Right.
And it just means someone who performs on the street and passes the hat for his income, whether he does it full-time or professionally, or it doesn't really matter. And I got into it because, back in Rhode Island, Wheeler and I, he and I were working together. We coined the name High Street Circus. We started doing gigs around campus. At the very beginning, we were just doing music and mime. Wheeler was studying mime, pantomime, and he was writing mime skits. And I would write music to them on the guitar and accompany him. And, and then we started adding juggling. And then the whole children's theater came in when I started doing that in the summertime. And, I started just making money performing. And after 5 years, I was on the 5-year plan in college. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Same here.
And after 5 years of that, we met the Flying Karamazov brothers.
Wow.
You know them.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, they're nationally, and have been for 30 years, a nationally touring juggling act. And they came and did a show at our school and completely blew us away. And we invited them to park their bus at our house, and they spent the night with us. And the next day, they just told us all these stories. And they told us how they had started as street performers in San Francisco.
Oh.
So, boom, diddy, boom, ching, ching. You know, there we go. Oh, that gives me an idea.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a career turning point for you guys.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so Wheeler and I decided to give that a try. Now, we really didn't know this at the time, but at the time, the street performing scene in San Francisco had been going great guns for a couple of years and was really starting to become a mecca for street performers. So we didn't know this. We just went there. And so we spent 2 months driving out, you know, taking the scenic route, driving around the country.
Yep.
Filled our van with all of our juggling props and our musical instruments and a couple tuxedos, costumes, and fire-eating stuff and, you know, the works. And just headed out. And when we got there, we were trying to get into, there were four private sort of malls down at Fisherman's Wharf that had stages. And these stages were by audition only. And the biggest, most famous one is Pier 39 in San Francisco.
Oh, I was just there last fall, yeah. It's wonderful
yeah.
there.
Yes, right. And but there were four other stages like that down there at the Cannery, the Anchorage Shopping Center, and Ghirardelli Square.
Yep.
And we arrived at a time when there was still room on the roster, and we auditioned, and we got into all of those stages.
What era are you talking about, Andrew?
This is the 80s.
Okay.
This is the 80s. And so all of a sudden, you know, we were giving, and the stages were scheduled, and they were time-slotted. So unlike the actual streets, which is public property, you can go out and get a permit and do whatever you want. On the stages, you know, you can't do back-to-back-to-back-to-back shows. You have to have some downtime in between your shows, because otherwise, you know, the store owners get upset. So, but between the four stages, all of a sudden we were working 5-6 days a week.
You know,
wow.
Doing 3, 5, 6, 7 shows a day.
And you get some pretty nice-sized crowds out there, too. There's a lot of people there.
Well, there are. Now, we arrived when the off-season began. The off-season begins after Labor Day. And the place empties out. So when we arrived, plus we were new, so we didn't really get weekend time. We just got daytime and daytime or weekday evenings. So, you know, there weren't that many people. But that was a good thing because we had to learn how to do a street show. We'd never done a street show before. So we'd kind of spend their time walking around, looking at all the other acts and seeing what they did. And then we'd get our time and then we'd go out and give it a try. And the first thing you have to do is learn how to gather a crowd. And it can be kind of tricky, but when it wasn't too bad because when there's not a whole lot of people there, you kind of have to entice them and invite them to watch your show one at a time. And that gave us a tremendous opportunity just to learn how to talk to strangers.
So what would be a good secret to gathering a crowd?
Well, when you're talking to strangers, you're basically just trying to make friends. And, you know, when you're accosted on the street by a stranger, a lot of people, their defenses go up and they don't want to talk to you. So it's kind of an exercise in charm, really.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're on stage. There's a stage there. You know, we've got props. We've got a small set. There are benches. So there's a certain amount of legitimacy going on. So you basically start with, where are you from? Because this is a tourist area, people from all over the world. You know,
right.
It's kind of the end. You start talking to people with, hey, where are you from? And you just start riffing on that. And we invite them to sit down, and you work at it 10 or 15 minutes, however long it takes, to try and get a core of maybe 6 or 8 or 10 people to sit down, you know, as your core audience. And if you can get 6 or 8 or 10 people to not only sit down, but sit down close to each other, so they're not a group of individuals, they're actually a group, an audience,
mm-hmm.
and then you can start your show. And once you start your show, you know, people hear it, and they see it, and they see there's people sitting, so they'll come over and they'll join them. And that's kind of a tricky little bit of engineering that you have to learn, how to, you know, get enough people to start the show, and get them close enough together to act as an audience, and then have other people see that and respond by coming in. So we typically start the show with maybe 10 people. At the end of a 30-minute show, we might have 300.
Wow. That's the exact opposite of a typical music performance where people buy tickets in advance and the show starts at a certain time and they have to be there. In this case, you have to do all the legwork and make sure a crowd is there before you start.
Yeah. Well, that's what I'm doing now. And it's a whole different thing.
Absolutely fascinating. Now, I want to focus on the music just a little bit. I've heard some samples of your music, and from what I can tell, it sounds like you do a lot of music for films, videos, public service announcements, that kind of thing.
Well, I typically score my own videos. So most of the videos that I have online are videos that I have shot, produced, and I would typically add a piece of my own music to them. That's another way that kind of music led me in all these other directions. I actually thought a while about studying music and becoming a film composer
film. Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I'm self-taught. I'm self-taught on the guitar, and I have a very good knack for teaching myself, and I learn pretty quickly, but I wasn't really very good at reading music. And I think one of the reasons was by the time I started trying it, I was already so much better without reading music, I got impatient. and the other thing was, I said, well, I don't want to do it their way. I want to do it my way. So what am I reading their music for? You know? So I kind of dripped. So I ended up by scoring a lot of films, but they're all my own. So I kind of got what I wanted to do because I got to write music for film. But it's all short format. You know, all my stuff is 3 to 5 minutes, you know, 8 minutes tops.
And what kind of things? I saw one was a public service announcement, Johnny Seatbelt Says.
Yes. Did you see that one? That was one of my first commissioned videos.
Nice. Who commissioned that? What was that, for a Department of Transportation
that was
somewhere?
That was in Massachusetts. After Wheeler and I broke up, we're jumping all over here, but that's okay. After Wheeler broke up in the early 90s, I moved back to New England, and I received a grant from the, what was it called? It was called the Massachusetts Highway Safety Bureau. And they had just published an ad in the paper looking for ideas for traffic safety. They had a little bit of money. And I said, oh, I'm a video producer now. I'll pitch them a couple ideas. So I pitched them two ideas. And the one that they went for, Johnny Seatbelt, was basically ripped off from an old juggling routine that we used to do, where we used to juggle eggs.
It all ties in.
Juggle eggs. And, yes, it does all. Well, I learned so much, you know, from performing and from knowing how to kind of entertain an audience and entertain them with comedy and with visuals, that it was a very easy thing to translate to video.
Uh-huh.
One of the problems that I had career-wise is that no one would hire me to do that because, you know, on the job market, I was, you know, an older adult who, you know, was just starting out in video production. So all the jobs that I got, you know, were tech jobs, just shooting camera for all kinds of stuff, you know, corporate stuff, wedding stuff, legal depositions. And you know, my interest in video was in creating content and creating content using my particular style, using visuals, using music, using comedy. So anyway, I pitched this this group an idea about seatbelt safety, you know, using raw eggs, because we had this raw egg juggling routine, and you know, the idea of a raw egg in motion, it automatically sets you up for some pretty easy drama. And
yes.
So they went for it, and then of course I didn't really have the whole thing planned out. So once they went for it, I kind of said, oh, okay, now I got to figure out how to actually do it.
Yeah,
there is that.
That's funny. Now I have to ask you: do you still eat eggs? Because I read that you used to eat like 5 to 6 raw eggs a day.
We used to eat 5 to 6 raw eggs a day back in the day, but. You know, we had to do it right. People would be concerned about salmonella or whatever, so we only picked the good eggs. Our eggs that we used, they were pasteurized, they were organic, and they were homeschooled. So, you know, we didn't have any problem there.
Homeschooled eggs, that's right.
And, yes, I still eat eggs, but, no, I don't eat raw eggs anymore. And the other thing that I don't do anymore is, because when we used to eat the eggs, we had this routine where we would crack them into a wine glass, and then we would add in a couple drops of Tabasco, you know, and then we would toast the audience and then knock it back. So I don't eat the raw eggs anymore, and I can't eat Tabasco sauce anymore either. It just reminds me too much of those days.
I don't even know how you can even still look at an egg after all that. I mean, ugh.
Well, that routine was born out of necessity because we were trying to entertain through juggling, but we're just starting out, and we didn't have any technique. I mean, couldn't do any tricks, and we didn't know any jokes. That's what most of the jugglers down there at the time were doing, tricks and jokes.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't know how to do that. So we came up, my partner came up with this idea of, you know, the basic premise is I'm going to juggle three raw eggs, and if I drop an egg, I'll eat one raw. That's what I would say. And it worked so well because without us doing anything, they would all stop and they would turn and we would have their attention.
I would imagine.
You know, on premise alone. So, and then it turned into a kind of a glorified competitive egg toss, where we juggle and toss them back and forth, and whoever dropped it, and somebody always dropped it, whoever dropped it had to eat it. So you basically
made a career out of glorified college pranks. That's really cool.
Yeah, right?
Kind of. I like to think of it as slightly more skillful than college pranks, but maybe
yes,
not.
Yes. Well, it sounds like you were pretty skillful in college yourself, so yeah.
That's cute, Mike. Now, you've traveled all over the world doing your show, and one of the things that stood out to me is that Osaka, Japan, gave you the key to their city. I mean, what a great honor that was.
It was. We were invited over with a small bevy of performers. There were maybe 8 or 10 of us, and we were invited over to participate in a sister city festival because Osaka and San Francisco are sister cities.
Ah.
And it's kind of ironic, and I make this point in my show a couple times because I talk about, you know, what it's like to be a street performer and what people's perceptions are and how, you know, their perceptions don't necessarily match up to the reality of what a street performer can be. Because I've known, you know, hundreds of top-notch acts that either started on the streets or started and stayed on the streets. Most of them, you know, if you get good enough, you can work all kinds of venues.
Right.
So working the streets is just another venue. But some of the best entertainment I've ever seen has been from people who take up this style. But so the irony is that here we were, even in San Francisco, even though we're all making our living, we're all making good money, we all traveled to lots of other gigs, you know, you're still kind of looked down upon certently in the theater world as street performers. And, you know, you don't have the skills to work at a comedy club. I don't know. But so the irony was, in San Francisco and in America, we're kind of on the low end of the entertainment totem pole. In Japan and in Asia, street performers are at the high end of the entertainment totem pole. We're at the top.
Oh, wow. That's interesting.
That must have felt nice. Yeah.
In fact, there's this saying, and the saying goes something like, if you're a street performer in America, you're a bum. If you're a street performer in Europe, you're an artist. If you're a street performer in Asia, you're a god.
Oh, my God.
Wow. That must have
been
refreshing for you.
Isn't that funny? Oh.
Yeah. So, being invited to the Sister City Festival and performing, we were invited to perform on the steps of City Hall in Osaka, and we met the mayor along with our entourage and the other performers. And
did we lose Andrew?
Ceremonial. I'm still here. Are you still there?
I'm here.
I'm here. Do you hear me?
I hear you, Andrew. We might have lost Pam.
But I heard her say, uh-oh, did we lose Andrew?
Yeah, well, okay. Well, I think she'll probably try to jump back in. So go ahead. We'll keep going.
Okay. Where was it? Oh, it was just, you know, being bestowed. Oh, I found out the key to the city. It doesn't go to anything. It's somewhere along the way. So it's a little disappointing. I thought, you know, maybe the mayor's office or something, but no, no such luck.
At least the men's room, that would be helpful, you know.
Well, yeah. Yeah. But,
so tell us a little bit about the current show, The Road to High Street. What's that like? What's that all about?
Well, The Road to High Street, I knew when I was performing as a street performer with the High Street Circus. I knew a couple things. I knew, one, that the career couldn't last forever. And then I also knew that it was just, I just thought it was an interesting story. You know, the idea of people doing, not just us, there are lots of people that did it, of being street performers and that lifestyle. And so I began to think about back then about writing some kind of story about the career. And then years later, I saw a performance in San Francisco of a guy who basically told the story of his life, and he did it, and he was also a video producer, and he rolled in these video segments highlighting his storytelling. And he also played a little music, and it was the coolest thing I'd ever seen in my life, you know, because he was storytelling, so it was a very intimate performance. He talked about, you know, his career, and he talked about growing up, and he talked about issues with his family. So it was very poignant and touching. And he also talked about some of the video productions that he'd done, and he used to travel across the country and just document these wild and crazy things that he would find. And his videos were just outstanding. And the whole thing resonated with me so much, I thought, wow, I wonder if I could do something like that someday.
Yeah,
you know, it was just a thought. I had no idea how I ever possibly could. It was just so many aspects resonated with me so much. You know, the live storytelling, the music, the photography, the family history, the filmmaking, the you know, the subjects of the filmmaking, and I just began to see a lot of parallels between what he had done and what I was doing, and. So it was just a thought. And then years later, I moved back east, and I was able to enroll in graduate school. And so I went to school and got a graduate degree in video production.
Very good. So that kind of led you to the next level.
Well, what that did is that led me to the tools. And,
gotcha.
And it also led me to the program, which gave me the opportunity. And all of a sudden, you know, I had to come up with some kind of final project, and most video students do a documentary. And I said, okay, well, I'm going to do a documentary, but I'm not going to do a standard documentary. I'm going to do a documentary like the guy that I saw years ago, where I will stage it as a live performance. I will tell my story, and then I'll roll in all these segments. And so that's how I got started. And the first thing I had to do, Mike, is I had to go through all my boxes of old videos and old photographs and newspaper articles and find out what the heck I had.
Yeah.
And, you know, and this was all stuff that was like 15, 20 years old. It was on old format stuff. It wasn't labeled. I spent ages just kind of going through it. But I went through it, and whenever I'd find an interesting clip, you know, I would highlight it and then find some way to use it. And that's kind of how the thing got started. And I've been developing it ever since. That was over 10 years ago that I finished it as a project for school. And I've actually been able to continue working on it and continue developing it. And it's improved greatly over the years.
And in terms of a live show, what can the audience expect? What's the whole feel?
Well, it's basically me sitting on a stool. I got a laptop on my right. I got a guitar on my lap. And I have a big video screen on my left. and I address the audience very personably, very directly, and I just lead them on through this series of stories. And some of them are tightly choreographed with music and with images, kind of like a music video.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm sitting there playing the guitar and speaking live. And some of them are more stop and go, where I, you know, will tell a story without time constraints and, you know, cue in an image for a certain effect or, you know, and a lot of my images, they serve as either setups or punchlines. So, and I can sit there and I can interact with the video screen. I interact with the audience. I interact with my laptop if it acts up. Sometimes
yeah.
it does. And so it's a very interactive show where I'm sitting there. And about, I was thinking about this the other day, about 30% of my dialogue is spontaneous.
Oh, that's cool.
Because
that's...
I react to the people who are sitting in front of me. And so when I have a good crowd and they respond, that gives me a lot to work with.
Do they
that would
ask
make it
you
more
questions
fun.
During your show?
Not usually, but sometimes I prompt them.
Okay.
Or sometimes I set up a premise that leaves an obvious question hanging, and
mm-hmm.
I wait to see if they'll take the bait. And sometimes they do, sometimes they don't.
Okay. I was just wondering about that, you know, how interactive it was that way. But it's still, I mean, it sounds like an amazing show. And what I've seen on video of, you know, the preview of it, I would definitely love to see that one day.
Well, come on out. I got plenty of tickets left.
Believe me, if I could go to California right this second, I'd be on a plane. But
okay. And where again are you, Tim?
I'm in Chicago.
Chicago, okay. Well, they got the Chicago Fringe Festival. Maybe I'll come out.
Yeah, you have to check into that. I mean, there's a lot of theaters around here. I would imagine they have to have something like that. Now,
yeah, well, there's definitely a Chicago Fringe Festival. There definitely is that.
Is there? Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, then we'll have to check that out. Now, another thing I was curious about was at one point you lived in a beer tank. You've got to explain that to me.
That is correct. And I'm glad you brought that up. I do make a great point of pitching that idea. And that's one of the things that made me think that this is a really interesting story, just because I have this story. But the story is, you know, we moved out to San Francisco. We didn't know anybody out there. I did have a relative out there that I had met once, and he was kind enough. My uncle Edward was kind enough to put us up for a week. We didn't really want to stay much longer.
Mm-hmm.
But so we're there and we're you know, trying to find a place to live in San Francisco. And we didn't have any money and certainly didn't have any jobs. So that kind of scratched out filling out a rental application because that's the first thing they ask you is where do you work and
yeah.
how much do you make?
Can you pay for this thing? Yeah.
Right. And so it's like, well, that's a no. And, you know, we had already started performing, and we were making money. Not a lot of money, because our show wasn't very good, but we were still making money in our head. And we had heard about, like, live workspace, artist warehouse space, and there were a couple places in the Mission District in San Francisco that were kind of very well-established, remodeled warehouse space where artists could live and work. Now, those, you know, there's 10-year waiting lists to get into those. But then we read, we saw an ad in the paper that was advertising artist warehouse space. So we said, oh, cool, we'll go check that out. So we drove in, and then we arrived, and what we discovered is what they were offering was a building that used to be part of the Hams Brewery.
Ah.
Where they brewed Hams beer. And the building that they were offering contained storage vats that used to age the beer.
Mm-hmm.
So they were renting out beer vats.
Interesting.
Right. That's what we said.
Interesting.
We kind of we kind of walked in, and the first thing you notice is the stench of stale beer. It sounds like,
oh,
you know,
gosh,
it smells like a week-old frat party. It's got 10 times stronger. And we walk in, and, you know, it's this long hallway, and it's all tiled, and on either side there are these, like, portholes. It's like the size of a manhole. And the street, you know, there are these
mm-hmm.
holes in the side of the wall, about the size of a manhole cover. And it was a vessel meant to hold liquid.
Right.
And people were living in them. And
huh.
most of these people were kind of like, otherwise they would have been homeless people. They were kind of, you know, a little bit on the bum side and didn't have any money and probably subsisted on city assistance. And, you know, it didn't cost much and it was out of the weather. So, you know, they're living in a beer tank. And then, you know, we had our reasons. And we really didn't have any choice. And so it was the middle of the month. It was $200 a month. So we were able to give them $100, and we had a place to live. So there we were.
Wow.
How long
did you stay there?
Well, we stayed there for about a year.
Wow.
That long?
Yeah, well, yes, I'm afraid so. We got lucky because we didn't stay in the beer tank for very long because the landlords liked us a lot because we were the only people that were going out in the day and working.
We'd
go out down to Fisherman's Wharf and we'd, you know, try and learn our street show and we'd pass the hat and, you know, we'd make some money and then we'd come home and, you know, we used to have this trick where we'd dump all of our hat money onto the floor. And then it's okay, one for you, one for me, one for us. One for you, one for me, one for us. You know, the
mm-hmm.
one for us was the business pool.
Mm-hmm.
And,
right.
That's where the rent money came from. And so we paid our rent, you know, every month on time and in cash, and we're working for it. So they liked us, so they gave us a chance to move out of the beer tank and move up to the top floor where there was this facility room that they let us move into. And it was a great big room with a great big sort of double door on it that looked out over the Mission neighborhood. And it was called the Yeast Culture Room. And this is where they used to culture to grow the yeast for the fermentation
yeah.
process. And now it became our home. So we got to live in there for part of the duration.
Well, at least you had windows at that point. I mean, at
we
least,
did.
I don't. I can't imagine living somewhere where you don't have windows.
Well, I can. You know, what was really weird about it is, you know, you'd go to bed at night and you'd wake up and you would have no idea what time it was because it's pitch black and it's always pitch black. And, you know, the place always sounded a little weird because the people who lived there, you know, some of them were a little unstable. And
right.
It was very windy, and so you could hear the wind blowing, and you could hear the echoing of all these sounds, and you'd hear, you know, screaming and laughing and moaning and partying and whatever, crying. And that would all kind of mishmash together into this reverberation. And, you know, you'd wake up in the middle of the night, and it could be 3 o'clock in the morning, it could be 3 o'clock in the afternoon. You have no idea which one
right.
it was. And it was very bizarre.
Wow. You know, I'm the type of person that has to see the sunshine and has to have a window. I guess if it came down to it, you know, you have to do what you have to do. And you have to have a roof over your head, no matter if it's got windows or doors or not. If it's just
right.
got a hole to walk through, that's what you
right.
do, you know, in the meantime until you can move somewhere else. So
right.
I'm glad
right.
you made it to the top floor at that point.
Yeah, the East Culture Room was great.
Yeah.
yeah. Can you still drink beer, or is it like eggs? You just can't deal with it
no,
anymore.
No, it's not like eggs at all.
Okay.
Well,
in fact,
we're
I
getting.
Probably have a...
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
I probably have a more fondness, an appreciation of beer now.
Yeah.
yes. The culture
in
of beer.
In fact, when I did my shows in Fresno at the Fresno Rogue Festival. I performed at a venue that was a bar and a brewery. They brewed their own beer. And when they saw my piece, because I have a piece on living in the beer tank, and I have all these pictures of the interior and of the yeast culture room and of the inside of the beer tank where we lived.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very graphic. And, you know, and when they saw that, I kind of made some real new friends because they thought, boy, anybody who's been living in a beer tank, you know, is... we had a lot to talk about in terms of brewing beer.
I can imagine. I think you were probably at the Full Circle Brewing Company, right?
That is correct.
Yeah, I have a friend who's involved with the Rogue Festival, Blake Jones from Blake Jones and the Trike Shop, and you sound like you're right up his alley because he loves all sorts of cool arts and entertainment type stuff.
Yes. In fact, I remember, I recall Blake. I did meet Blake when I was there last year. Does he play the theremin?
Yes, he does. He was playing in a trio. It was theremin, harp, and percussion.
I saw them. I saw them last year. They were very, very good.
They are good. He'll use the theremin in pop music, so he plays guitar as well in his other band. But he's just my shining example of all that is good and right in the art scene in Fresno.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I didn't get to know him real well, but you did get to meet him and see him work, and he was very, very good.
Well, that's interesting. You guys have things in common, you know, so maybe next time you're out to see Blake, you can catch Andrew.
I hope so, yeah.
Well, I will strive to be back to the Fresno Festival. That was a fun festival, and that's in March, I think. So
yeah, March every year, yeah.
Yeah, I hope to be back to that.
Well, you sure wouldn't be doing a festival in Chicago in March.
Well, you know, the New York Fringe Festival is in February, and they call
You're
it the Frigid
kidding.
Festival.
Oh, my God.
They call it the Frigid Festival.
Yes.
Yeah, it's more like
no
it. Oh, my gosh. Well, we're getting to the top of the hour here, and I would like to let our listeners know where they can check out your show. It's the Hollywood Fringe Festival, and Andrew will be there June 14th, 23rd, 28th, and 30th at the Theater Asylum, which is at 6320 Santa Monica Boulevard. Tickets are $10, and you can find them on hollywoodfringe.org. Now, do they have to buy these ahead of time, or can they purchase them once they get to the festival?
Well, presumably, if it's not sold out, and,
mm-hmm.
you know, frankly, none of my shows have been sold out yet, so if they're not sold out, you can certainly get them at the door.
Okay, good to know. Also, check out Andrew's website for upcoming shows, news, and more about him at theroadtohighstreet.com. And then you're also on Facebook, so be sure to like his page. It would be facebook.com/ Andrew Potter's Road to High Street. And you can follow him on Twitter at Road to High Street, and the 2 is the number 2. Can they find you anywhere else, or do they pretty much cover all your social media?
That pretty much covers it. That pretty much covers it.
Wonderful. Well, I want to say break a leg for the rest of your shows, but I always feel guilty saying that because I don't want that to really happen. But and I want to thank you for joining us today. It was such
well,
an interesting show.
Thank
You're
you.
Welcome.
Yeah, great. Nice meeting you, Andrew.
All right. Thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. You're welcome back anytime. Keep in touch, and we'll let listeners know where you're going to be next.
Okay, cool. Thank you.
All right. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you. Take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye, Andrew.
Well, I've only seen a few street performers, and that's basically when I was around, like, you know, Disneyland area. I'm trying to think. Oh, New Orleans, too. In New Orleans, I've seen some street performers, but that's about it. And that's always very interesting to me, especially, like, mimes and that, too. I think they're very talented people.
Absolutely. And the area that he got his start in, Fisherman's Wharf in San Francisco, it really is a pretty amazing place for that. I saw, in the same day, last fall, I saw a guy who was sort of dressed as a silver robot. His body was painted all in silver. And I saw another guy who was a sword swallower. And honestly, I'd never seen that done in person. That's kind of scary looking. But
oh,
the guy
gosh,
is really
yeah.
I mean,
it's hard
really,
to
really,
even watch on TV.
Yeah. I mean, he really did do that. I mean, you could almost see his eyes watering a little bit when he was doing that. So he knew he was really doing a sword.
Wow. No, yeah. That's not one of my cups of tea.
I wouldn't want to miss, you know, would not want to miss.
Yeah, that's pretty dangerous. I mean, it's like Andrew playing with fireballs, so, you know.
Yeah.
Not a good idea.
No, you need adult supervision for that sort of thing. And it sounds like Andrew has never had adult supervision in his life, and that's why he's got such a great career.
Right, right. Yeah, definitely. I mean, there was nobody around to tell him, no, you can't do that. And that's a good thing because you always want to try your best, you know, on something you enjoy doing.
Absolutely. And he clearly sounds like he's having fun. And that's what I loved about chatting with him.
Oh, my gosh. My dogs want to get into the conversation now. But I want to thank you for joining me again today, Mike. And for our listeners, please listen to Mike on Toro Radio. Mike, go ahead and tell them just a little bit about your show.
I appreciate it. It's a music show. I feature the finest music from the rock era. Saturdays, 4 to 6 p.m. Pacific. That's 7 to 9 p.m. Eastern time. And that is www.twirlradio.com. And if I can throw in one more thing, I'm going to be doing my 600th episode on Saturday, June
29th. Oh, my gosh. Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you.
Does it feel like it?
No, not even. It feels like I should be a little bit better at it by this point, but it's a lot of fun.
And that's just your thinking, mister, because I told you I love what you do. I think you're fantastic at what you do.
Well, thank you. And we're going big that day. We're going to expand to 3 hours, and I've got three interviews, including a performance and probably a lot of greetings from many of the artists I play, and maybe even some audio from when I was really new at it.
I'd love to hear that.
Yeah, I've got some stuff from about 15 years ago from the late 1990s where I was kind of fresh and green and maybe not as good at it as I might be today. Might be kind of interesting.
Well, that's the same thing like I am, you know, thinking back to when I started my show, and not even that long ago, November of last year.
Right.
And how I've grown since then, it amazes me. Let's put it that way.
I think it's fantastic. You're a force now. I mean, you've gotten hundreds of thousands of listeners. That's just phenomenal. I am just so thrilled by that, Pam.
Thank you. April 29th, a day I'll never forget, I had over 1 million listeners/downloads. So December, January, February, March, April, within 5 months' time.
That's phenomenal. You're a force.
I'm very, very, very blessed and very thankful and grateful to everybody that's contributed to that as well. All my co-hosts, you know, I had Dawn at one time. I have you. I have Mike Ricucci from Terra Rising and David and Sabina. Everybody's helped along the way and contributed so much, and not just even on air but behind the scenes as well. So I appreciate and am grateful to all of you.
Well, it takes a team, but you know, you're putting together a really nice show, and you've hit topics that people really love, you know, between the daytime TV dramas and music, and now stuff like Andrew Potter with just some wildly entertaining stories. I think it's a great show, and I could see why you have a lot of appeal.
Thanks, and thanks to Suzanne Panetto too, because she's the publicist that sets me up with a lot of the shows that I have, a lot of the guests that I have, and Andrew is one of hers, and she's the sweetest person in the world. So I am very thankful to her as well. So anyway, thanks again for joining us. Follow our show on Twitter at Take Two Radio, and that's with the number 2. Check out our website for upcoming guests, previous podcasts, and more at take2radio.com. You can also follow Mike when he's on Twitter at Twirl Radio. We need to get you into that more, Mike.
Yes, definitely.
Follow the show on Blog Talk Radio. They'll send you out an email each and every time we have a guest scheduled. And you can also listen for free to the previous podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Stitcher is a mobile app that you can download to any of your mobile devices and somehow in your car, too. I'm not sure how that works because I've never used it, but that's the email I have gotten recently from Stitcher. And with that, I'm going to say thank you, everybody, and have a wonderful rest of the day, and God bless you. We'll see you again soon. Check out the website and Twitter for any upcoming shows. I don't have any scheduled right now. I'm taking a little bit of a break. So take care, everybody. Thanks again, Mike. You enjoy the rest of your day as well.
Thanks. You too, Pam. Bye, everybody.
Thank you. Bye-bye.